Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for your patience. I apologize for starting a little bit behind schedule. We've got a lot of scheduling conflicts today, so just trying to get all the ducks in order. But I call this meeting of the House Tribal Affairs Committee to order. It is now 3:37 p.m., Wednesday, March 6, 2024, in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Allard, Representative Dybert, Representative Carrick, Representative Carpenter. Excuse me. Representative Carpenter is not here, but I am here, Representative McCormick, Chair. It's like reading the teleprompter. I'll just read anything you put in front of me. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, I would like to thank Annie Goodenough, the House Tribal Affairs Committee Secretary from Records, and Talia Ames from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. I apologize, Ms. Ames. I was trying to get the pronunciation correct because I know I got it wrong. Today is the second hearing for HJR 17. My staff, Callan J. Sifsoff, will provide a brief recap of this resolution and can answer any questions from the committee. We also welcome back Benjamin Jacek, Indigenous researcher at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, and Emily Edenshaw, President of Alaska Native Heritage Center, who joins us virtually on the monitor. I know I kind of unfortunately didn't let them go through their slide deck in totality because we were running out of time. I know they had to speed up, and so I kind of also closed the committee without allowing folks to ask any questions that we might have. So I'm hoping that we will be able to do that today. We also will be opening for public testimony today. However, I don't believe we have anyone in the room, or do I see anyone signed up currently to testify. So we'll see how things go. Nonetheless, Callan, or excuse me, Ms. Dreyfus-Sifsoff, please put yourself on the record, and if you would, please begin your recap. I'm going to take a brief at ease. Brief at ease. Thank you very much, everyone. We just needed to get the screen turned back on in front of us here. So, Ms. Dreyfus-Sifsoff, if you could just provide a brief refresh re-overview of HJR 17, that'd be greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Callan Chethick-Sifsoff, staff for Rep. McCormick, and this is a really brief recap, and then I'm going to hand it over to Ben and Emily from the Alaska Native Heritage Center to continue their presentation if need be, and we also have that presentation loaded up if they need to reference slides and also additional questions to their research and body of work. House Joint Resolution 17 urges the United States Congress to pass the Truth and Healing Commission on Indian Boarding School Policies Act. HJR 17 supports its simple resolution in support of U.S. Senate Bill 1723, again, which is supporting the Federal Truth and Healing Commission on Indian Boarding School Policies Act. This resolution makes reference to the 2022 report, the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative Investigative Report findings. It pays nod to this because that was the body of work and research that led to Senate Bill 1723. And additionally, if there are any questions about the rest of the body of the resolution, I can answer that. It pays nod to the Alaska Native Heritage Center's body of work and research. What they shared on Monday was just a very small snippet of their many year long work to compile source records. And again, I'll let Ben and Emily speak to that. And then at the last part of this resolution recognizes the Alaska Federation of Natives resolution this year in support of S-1723. I'm going to leave all of the factual content of my presentation and yield it to Ben and Emily, but as you guys heard on Monday, there's ample data currently and much more data to be compiled to account for the abuse and trauma of the boarding school era in Alaska. Here on this slide, It summarizes the institutional practices that were a daily occurrence at these schools, and it also illustrates just again a snippet of some of the traumas that were experienced. With the passage of Senate Bill 1723, the hope and intent of this is to acknowledge the harm, the assimilation and elimination of culture that occurred in that era, and also similar to the work of the Alaska Native Heritage Center and what they've already done to compile data, records, and occurrences of these cases in order to validate these first-person accounts that are across Alaska and ensure that these atrocities were recognized so that we may heal and move forward from them. Senate Bill 1723 has 29 bipartisan co-sponsors as of Monday, and a major champion of the bill is Senator Lisa Murkowski, who has taken this issue on personally. This is a four of many schools across over 100, and again, Ben and Emily can speak to the exact numbers, but across Alaska there are over 100 citable references to mission schools. Around Juneau, we have the Wrangell Institute, which was one of the worst. Sheldon Jackson College is still standing and in operation today. Presbyterian Mission School was located downtown here, so this photo reminded me of kind of each day that I walk downtown and I do, when I see the infrastructure of that time, I do immediately think about the family that I have that suffered abuse and horrors. So for me as an Indigenous person walking around Juneau, even it reminds me of unaddressed trauma. And so I think with support of this resolution, it serves to heal and allow the current population of Indigenous people in the state of Alaska, our elders that exist today and survive today. And it helps to validate the pain and the experience of that era. And I just want to thank you guys very much for listening to my presentation, and also Qiyanakfa to Dr. Waki Charles and Gunas Chish to Dr. Rosita Worrell for being here and providing strong support of this with their first person account. And I'll yield down to Ben and Emily, and feel free to speak to any additional statements that you'd like to make about your presentation. And then we also would like to open up questions to myself or Emily or Ben.
Thank you very much, Cowan. I'll go first with introductions. Benjamin Chasek. My name is Benjamin Chasek. I'm Dena'ina Athabascan and Supiak, and a tribal enrolled member of the Kenai Indian Nation, and very excited to be here, talking about this very important issue today. And I'll let Emily introduce herself as well.
Yeah, thank you. I hope everyone can hear me. Good afternoon. My name is Emily Edenshaw. I'm Yupik and Anupiaq. My family comes from Emonik, Alaska, and I have the honor to live and work on the Dena'ina lands. And I serve as the president and CEO for the Alaska Native Heritage Center. We're the only statewide living cultural center in Alaska that represents the entire state. I love the work that I get to do here at the Heritage Center. We were born out of our community for our community. So I often say that I have the best job in Alaska. Outside of work, I am a PhD candidate at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. My entire doctoral research has focused on healing from boarding school experiences. And so I've interviewed boarding school survivors. And as I shared during our presentation earlier this week, when we start talking about this history, it falls into it's complicated category because it's a very long history, especially when we start talking and going back to the 1800s and 1700s, but also just understanding and being, you know, kind of leaning into the fact that not everybody had a bad experience, not everybody had a good experience. But what I always go back to is really just the fundamental right. You know, this history is not being taught around Alaska, even though every single Alaska Native person is alive today, has been impacted either directly or indirectly. And so just really looking at this House resolution as an opportunity to support the healing for a community that really, you know, Alaska would not be the state that it is today if it wasn't for the Alaska Native community. And so getting behind a resolution that really supports the healing and the good work that the Heritage Center is doing, and really, you know, just getting behind and championing the healing and supporting a community as well as a state to understand its own history. One thing I didn't share during my presentation earlier this week, and I want to say thank you again for inviting us to be here. This is the first time that I've ever testified when it comes to this body of work. But one thing I wanted to share with you all is I have a personal story as well. My grandfather went to boarding school, and for those of you who know me know that I have a similar story to many other Alaska Natives. I wasn't raised in my community. My mother was adopted out at birth. She was part of a forced adoption. And when I met my biological family, I was 18, and I had asked my Inupiaq grandfather to speak our language to me. And even though I was 18 and he was an elder at the time, he refused to speak our native language to me because what happened to him at boarding school. And I want to share this story. Something my Auntie Liz often tells me is the closest distance between two people is a story. And I want to share that story because that really was a catalyst for me. I immediately went to Google, and I was really confused when I heard him say, no, I don't, you know, I don't speak my language because of what happened in boarding schools. I went to Google and I tried to go research what he meant by that. And at that time, you know, I'm 40 now, I just turned 40. There was no information. And so when we look at an opportunity that's before us today, just know that, you know, you have partners like Ben and myself who are really trying to center healing. We're not trying to vilify or, you know, put any sort of negative energy into this work. I know for myself, and this is something that, and, you know, an elder once told me, when I heal myself, I heal my ancestors who have come before me. Unfortunately, my grandfather has passed on, but even to this day, I believe that as I do this work and as my community, you know, as we get closer to, you know, to uncovering the truth and working with our community to ensure that these stories are being told, I believe with every part of my being, you know, my grandfather is healing as well. And so I wanted to share that story. That wasn't something that I shared earlier this week, but just know that I do this work in partnership with Ben and with my entire community. And I think at really at the root of it, you know, it's getting behind a resolution that really champions, you know, the healing, the safety, the well-being of Alaska's First Peoples. And as I shared in my presentation earlier this week, Alaska would not be the state that it is today if it wasn't for Alaska Native people and our cultures. So with that, I want to say thank you again for inviting me and for listening to my story. But just know that, you know, we're partners in this work. And I just want to thank our elected officials for all of the work that you do, not only for the Alaska Native community, but for the state.
Thank you.
President.
Something.
Please continue. I apologize.
I mean, for every Alaska Native, it was something that we emphasized over on Monday, that this is something that every Alaska Native has a story about. This is something that every Alaska Native has been impacted by. I mean, for instance, and this is something that I shared with a few people in the room, like with Dr. Whirl and Dr. Charles, is that I much like Emily, like I heard about the boarding schools growing up, but never complete. It was something that my grandfather talked about, but there was always something that there was an unspoken story. And it wasn't actually until I went to seminary, went over to Princeton Theological Seminary that I actually started to recognize not only the impact it would have on me, or that it continues to have on me, my own family, our cousins, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, and those who will come after us, but just how much there is still yet to learn about, not only the stuff that has been done, but the stuff that continues to occur, that still continues to affect every single one of us. And it wasn't until my first semester or first year at seminary that I actually realized why no other Alaskan Native have ever graduated or attended one of the oldest seminaries in the United States. And that was because it was the alma mater of Sheldon Jackson. And that would be the place where we actually, while it seemed somewhat of like a curse back then, now it seems almost like a blessing, because now we're able to actually tell this story with all the resources that we've been able to find. And something that Callan mentioned earlier is how we've been able to collect a lot of these bodies of works. That's really been in partnership with a lot of these ecclesial institutions, the Presbyterian Church, Baptist Church, and so on. Yeah, the Catholic Church, even. Because we had a slide discussing historical amnesia, that a lot of this story hasn't either been told or has been forgotten. And that's really the same for a lot of these churches, where it's a story that has been forgotten. But even by their own admission, specifically from the Presbyterian Church, it's a story that has been forgotten on purpose. And in order to not only find healing, but understand what forgiveness, what repentance starts to look like, that's a story that they've also wanted to know about themselves. Because we have talked about how it's affected Alaska Native peoples, but at the same time, it is a story that also impacts all these various churches that want to find healing, that want to understand forgiveness, that want to understand repentance. And so that's why we've been very blessed to be able to do this research with archives that have been, for the most part, unread that's about us for the last 100 years to be able to tell this story and to see how it affects us. I did have discussed briefly about structural violence. That is something that we can talk about if anyone has any questions on. It is taken from Johann Goltung's work, Violence, Peace, and Peace Research, which he did receive a Nobel Peace Prize for. But really, in terms of looking at it from that lens, we're starting to begin to understand outside, even broader than just trauma, how structures have been a place that still negatively affect Alaskan Native peoples as a result of the boarding schools. And one thing that Callan did mention is the number of schools. Right now, based upon Department of Interior's criteria for what can be defined as a boarding school, and through looking through the primary source material found in various collections throughout the United States, we've been able to verify upwards of about right now, we're seeing at about 100. We're expecting that to grow as time is going on. It's in terms of the criteria and how we're defining it. We even had So we took the opinion of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, who is also doing a fantastic job within this work. And they agreed that the way that we have understood and interpreted the criteria to be also to be absolutely valid and on point. So and we plan on publishing this within the next year or so. Emily.
Yeah, and I had one more thing that I want to add. I apologize, and something that I didn't include in our presentation. I know it was on one of the last slides. So in October 2023, we had worked with our community and we passed, as Callan mentioned, there was a resolution that unanimously passed at AFN supporting, really positioning the Heritage Center to be the institution that, you know, we've been doing this work, but really in terms of archives and research, there is a resolution that unanimously passed. 2 days after AFN, the Heritage Center raised the first healing pole in not only Alaska, but in our country. The healing pole was really an idea that came from Norma Jean Dunn, whose grandmother went to Carlisle Institute. And I want to share this story, this brief story, just to share with the committee that we had over 1,000 people, both Native and non-Native, show up to that one pole raising event. I think oftentimes we try to quantify our impact in terms of people that we work with and, you know, number of visitors through the door, so on and so forth. But that day, to see 1,000 people come through our door and champion behind the healing from an era, where else in Alaska is this happening? And when I shared earlier, we are not trying to do this work to vilify or to put any sort of negative energy in this. This is a resolution around healing and the positive energy and the work that we're doing. Like Ben mentioned, we have partnerships with churches, with universities. We're happy to provide that list to the committee if they'd like to see it. But some of these institutions, they really, from what I've seen, in order for them to move forward, they need to have some of kind of the parameters that are outlined in the Senate bill in 1723. So I want to share that context that the Heritage Center, you know, we've been doing this work with and for our community, and the raising of the healing pole was historic. And like I said, nowhere in Alaska are you getting 1,000, you know, some of your residents, your voters from your districts came to that pole raising, and know that we are in a time of healing. We are in an era of healing. And I think this resolution just really complements that and allows us to continue doing the work that we're doing. And so just know that we're partners. We are not here to vilify. We're here to continue to put our positive energy into this work, because at the end of the day, both the Alaska Native community and Alaska, we have a right to know what happened during this time. We have a right to know our own history. We have a right to healing when we start talking about this era. So I wanted to add that context around the work that we're doing with the healing pole. Something else I will end on. Since raising that healing pole, we were invited to apply for $3.5 million to raise 10 more healing monuments. So just know that the Heritage Center, we are centering healing in our work. And so if you'd like to know more about that work, please let us know. But as I mentioned earlier, we are in a time of healing, and we really, we really hope that you get behind and you champion this resolution. So thank you.
Luna, President Edenshaw, Mr. Jacek, I want to thank you both for coming back and speaking on this some more, and dedicating your time to this committee, but also just for the breadth of research that you both have done on this topic. I wanted to open up the floor for questions of Callan, Jaithluk-Sipsoff, or Mr. Jacek, or President Edenshaw. Representative Ellard.
Thank you. Can you enlighten me and tell me when the last boarding school was closed down. Looking on the slides here, it said 1932, the BIA takes over education of Alaska Native population. Was that the last time that a boarding school was open? Do you guys know the last date the school closed, please? Thank you, Chair. Appreciate it. Through the chair. Sorry. I totally violated all the rules.
I can answer that. So with the New Deal in 1932, the definition of how a boarding school would be run, and that the majority of them would be under Bureau of Indian Affairs or Bureau of Indian Education, was something that's why we kind of use the era perspective, just because it's such a long time span. But in terms of 1932, that's more of a defining factor of, you know, BIA taking over the majority of schools. Keep in mind that still a lot of these institutions, while being BIA or BIE funded and taken over, that they were still, you know, a lot of times run by ecclesiastical institutions. In terms of those that had opened or closed, I mean, Mount Eskom is still around. Yeah. And obviously opinion, there's a lot of opinions about that. Obviously they are from my understanding, they are not an assimilative institution that is still doing the kind of same work that you would see with like Sheldon Jackson or anything past 1969, which is when kind of the cutoff date for the Bureau, for Department of Interior to define whether or not boarding school, you know, fits within their criteria. But yeah, and so technically, there still are those that are around, but at the same time, in terms of change of policy, 1970, 1969 are critical dates.
It's okay. Oh, I just
go ahead.
So, just to confirm, mm-hmm. though, 1932 was the last time, and BIA then took over the boarding schools, correct? I just want to confirm that information. Is that? I see it here on a slide. I just want to make sure. BIA takes over education of the Alaska Native population in 1932.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But still there are schools that are being, you know, depending on whether or not or how they got federal funding, there still are independent ecclesial schools that would open up here and there that would still receive federal funding. But yeah. Overall overreaching, you know, overall that would be factual. Now did BIA go over and, open up schools right after? That is correct. And Wrangell Institute is a prime example of that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jacek. Follow up, Representative Ellard. Okay. I apologize for interrupting you, Mr. Jacek. I thought you were done. Are there any other questions from the committee to either our presenters or Ms. Jaithlik-Sifsoff? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just reading through the actual act in Congress, and this looks like a pretty straightforward piece of legislation. But I just wanted to kind of get an understanding of the experience of our Alaska Natives in the boarding school process, because some of the testimony was talking about a very short time frame. And I'm trying to understand the intent of removing children and how long they were originally proposed to attend these boarding schools, because the experiences that we heard were 1 year, 3 years. Do you know, based upon the research that you've done, what the plan was and how some of the children only ended up staying for 1 year, for instance? What did they, after the 1 year and they returned home, what was their education? I'm just trying to get that kind of the feel of kind mm-hmm. of what took place.
I could go ahead and respond to that. So As we shared in our presentation, we have, in terms of the landscape, we know that we stand on the shoulders of other academics, one being Dr. Diane Hirschberg, who I believe she's at UAA at ICER. She was really one of the first academics that interviewed boarding school survivors. She interviewed over 60 boarding school survivors. The timing in which, where they attended schools, how long they stayed there, it's going to vary. We actually have primary source documents showing, and I'm happy to provide this to the committee, where whether if it was the church or the federal government, they would come in and take children. They would take them as young as, you've heard stories of as young as 5, as young as 4. We've also heard in terms of length staying as long as 18. So what you heard from the two, from Dr. Worrell and Dr. Waukee Charles, I don't want to say that's a one size fits all, and I don't want to minimize just because they were there for, you know, under 5-year period, or if they were there longer, you know, understanding that what was carried out there, as we heard from both the testimonies, it was very traumatic. And so to answer your question, and some of the boarding school survivors that I've interviewed through my doctoral research, one of the, you know, the students that went there went at 8 and left at 18. And so just to provide some context, and I come to this space as a mother, imagine, and this is where, you know, when I was hearing Dr. Roll's testimony, you know, I have a 5-year-old little girl. Imagine the federal government or churches absolutely being legal to come in and take our kids as young as 5, send them, not being able to communicate with them, no birthdays, you know, no communication, you know, or limited communication. Also being in a place where, as we heard, some of the various forms of abuse were taken out, and this was completely legal. And so, again, to answer your question, it's going to vary, and I'm happy to provide some of those primary source documents to you, but this is another reason why we need to continue doing this research to ensure that we, I don't want to say capture, but we record those experiences. And as we shared in our presentation earlier this week, the Heritage Center is working with the National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition. And in fact, we're going to be interviewing, I believe it's going to be 20 boarding school survivors in April, as part of that work that NABS is going to be leading. And so it's going to vary, I guess, as a short response. But I don't want to diminish, even though if they were there for a year or for 3 years, some of the stories that are coming out and what's being carried out there were in many cases very traumatic. And I'm going to turn it over to Ben to see if he wants to add anything to that.
Thank you very much, Emily. So in 1885, when Shelton Jackson, just to go through some of the source material, there is a court case where Jackson was being, it was basically Jackson versus the U.S. government, where he was actively taking children from their place, you know, from their homes and everything. What ended up happening was the federal government, while ruling on the side, you know, of the parents at that point, as defined in the 1887 boarding school report on the report on education in Alaska, Jackson said, we're not going to follow that because we also need to now define what is an orphan. And his definition, and this is even on the first page of the 1887 education in Alaska report, he defined an orphan to be someone who only has one parent, or by his definition, and that's very important, his definition, parents who are unable to actually care for their kid. One of the determining factors, which has been established throughout our presentation, was his understanding of who was, quote, savage or a heathen, and that really based upon pseudoscience at best. That really opened the door to any child being able to be taken away. The reason for those dog tags were that if a child ran away, then they would be able to identify them and bring them back to school. And so very important parts. I mean, even within my own family, there was recently a letter from, or a collection of letters from NARA down over in the Pacific Northwest, where that actually talked about, you know, my own great uncle and aunt who got taken over to Aklutna, and my great grandfather, Mike Dolchak, said, I need to take my children back because this is not what you said it was supposed to be. That is a response that we hear time and time again. And so he ended up going to Aklutna with a lot of people from Kenai and Soldovia to get my great aunt and uncle back. Unfortunately, Mike Dolchak ended up passing away a few years later, which opened the door to my own grandfather being sent first to Seward Sanatorium, Wrangell, and so on, being passed from institution to institution. A lot of times when children were taken back, it was either by because, you know, their parents wanted them back for very obvious reasons. But just to give a really quick overview of close to 100 years of policy. I hope that I answered your question. Thank you.
Follow up, Representative Vance.
Follow up. Thank you for that clarification, because I too don't want to minimize the impact. I mean, trauma and abuse is what it is, but just, I think it's such a foreign concept for us to understand the mindset that they had originally in this plan. And I was trying to see how much of that has come up in the research. And it sounds like there was some lawlessness that just got perpetuated for a very long time. And somehow I missed that in your previous presentation. So thank you for clarifying that, because those things that matter in the course of the conversations about history and the impact. So thank you.
Thank you. And there was an aspect that I didn't answer in term which I spent several slides at the beginning, which it was a long presentation. But Jackson, through doctrines, usually, you know, from a Reformational or a Protestant perspective, had the American Protestant perspective, had the belief that kind of, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the term predestination, but that the United States was predestined to be the peoples of God, which was incredibly divorced from, you know, John Calvin, who is the founder of the Presbyterian Church, who was very individualistic. Really, that came about as a result of federal funding coming about, them creating and establishing that systematic theology. That was used time and time again for those who were not Reformational. And really, God's chosen people were then called, as a result of Interceptor of the Doctrine and Discovery, then to forcibly, the Catholics a lot of times use convert. For Protestants, it was forcibly assimilate. Where really Americanization and Christianity were one and the same. That's a major part of it. I also do want to highlight that all of this was 100% part of the law of the time. And so, yeah, thank you. Thank you for letting me clarify.
Mr. Athlixifsoft, did you have a comment?
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to thank you guys for your expertise and your invaluable work. And I just wanted to just reference, you know, as I'm learning as well about the background of the phenomenon and these pieces that they've been able to database and research, you know, it's the knowledge is helpful and powerful to understand it and understand these mechanisms and how it, you know, like you said, it was an era that in modern times is hard for us to put our our brains into. And I think the more that we can identify the components, it actually makes what had happened in that era clearer and more able to factually understand that, I think, is my perspective on that. Yeah. And then helps to heal and not have misperceptions about what had happened or hadn't in that era. Yeah.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. Yeah. Through the chair. I think it's interesting. I've never heard this aspect of the replacement theology in relation to the boarding schools. But I'm just looking at globally in this era, you look at the British Empire and their impact on India and other places in the world. Through your research, are you seeing very similar things in relation to that? And I find it interesting that the religious aspect is so intertwined in this. The reason I ask that is because you speak of the American theology with this, but we know that this happened to many other minority cultures in other places of the world kind of in this same time frame. I mean, this was kind of a global perspective that ruled in almost every region of the world, not to minimize the impact. I think it lasted a lot longer for Alaskan Natives than many other places in the world. But do you see a similar mindset and just practice that was carried out on Alaska Natives?
Do you want to go, Emily, or would you like me to?
You could go first, and then I'll go after.
Oh, thank you. So in terms of the replacement or in terms of reformational theology, it's really highlighted, just to answer the first question, it is highlighted in Charles Hodges' Systematic Theology, Volume 2, which is very unfortunately titled Theological Anthropology. A lot to unpack there. But in terms of kind of the global reach, that's why it's really important to understand the Comity Plan. And this being the first time where all these ecclesial institutions came together, because later on we find Presbyterian involvement in places like Korea. You find the same people within the Comity Plan then going over into Canada and continuing this ideology. In terms of India, kind of the same thing, because the Episcopal Church is barely closely and with a couple of technicalities, the same as the Anglican Church, them taking this kind of ideology mainly from a very warped Great Commission perspective for Wesleyan Arminian or people of that framework going over and doing that. And while we have been talking about a lot of the boards of home missions within the American groups, there's also boards of foreign missions that would go out and replicate it all throughout the world. You see a lot of discussion between the U.S. And, you know, what happened over in Australia with the Stolen Generation, over in New Zealand. Really, you see from Alaska, and this is from our own findings, you see from Alaska and also from the opinion of several individuals from Ford Theological Seminary and Princeton Theological Seminary in Yale, is this perspective that really, because of the early date of the Comity Plan, you see these forms being multiplied throughout the rest of the world, starting here. Really important in terms of the American realities, that's really the difference between like German theology and American theology, which the individual, the theologian Charles Hodge and Archibald Alexander established. So, thank you. I'll let Emily go now.
Yeah, thank you, Ben, and thank you for the questions. I want to just kind of lean into, you know, a lot of this history. You know, it's there have been so many aha moments, and when I hear you ask your questions, Representative, you know, I have the same experience where I'm learning in real time, and knowing that as a lifelong learner, you know, the Heritage Center and working with people like Ben and others across the country, you know, it really is, you know, I went through the education system and, you know, just really taking a moment to understand, you know, as I shared earlier, I'm 40 now, and there's certain parts of our history that I'm just learning. And, you know, when we've started uncovering this shared history, it's not just Alaska, you know, it's not just Alaska Native history. This is Alaska history, period. And as I've uncovered this and as I've learned, I think with that, I've had almost like a sense of grieving, but also like an aha moment, right? But with that comes a sense of responsibility, knowing that we need to do anything, you know, whatever we can to make sure that this information is available, not only to the Alaska Native community, but also to the non-Native community. I really want to also just touch on that. And as we shared in our presentation earlier this week, you know, knowing that, you know, going back to when Sheldon Jackson first came here and what he implemented in terms of some of the tactics, you know, as I've shared in my dissertation and to my committee, you know, I think there needs to be a body of work that really looks at what was carried out during the Russian period versus what was carried out really during the Jackson period. Because some of the assimilative tactics and the approach, and, you know, yes, some of the testimonies that we've heard varied earlier in the week, you know, some of the impacts, the lasting impacts, are still felt today. Language loss, family structures. You know, some of the assimilative tactics that were carried out, even going back to the 1800s, are still felt today. And, you know, in my opinion, and if I may, you know, one day is too long. One day is too long. I could not even imagine, you know, as a mother, and I will share, after the committee meeting on Monday, I went home and I cried. I looked at my daughter who was 5 years old, and I can't even fathom the federal government or any sort of body coming in and taking my 5-year-old little girl away from me and not being able to contact her. And just to really understand that this happened not only during the 1700s, but also during the 1800s and even into the 1900s. And so I just want to share that one day was too much. And again, this is why we need to continue doing this research, because at the end of the day, you know, our elected officials who are on this committee, but also other Alaskans, we have a right to know this history. So thank you again for your questions.
Follow-up, Representative Vance?
No, I'll have statements before we vote.
Sure. Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay. Hearing none, President Edenshaw, Mr. Jacek, I want to thank you again for donating your time this afternoon. We're going to move into public testimony, which I think will go by in a blaze. So if you could just maybe stay on in case there's any questions or comments that you want to provide before we wrap up, that'd be greatly appreciated. So we'll now move to public testimony, open public testimony. And I just want to survey the room. I don't believe you two are here to testify, are you? No. Okay. Just wanted to check. You never know. And we don't have anyone on the phone line, do we? No. Okay. So we'll go ahead and close public testimony. So, Representative Vance, you said you had some more statements you'd like to make. Would you like to make them now, or are you going to object to the motion to move the bill? What are we going to do?
However you'd like to do
it. Please, if you have comments you'd like to make, please go right ahead.
Well, I just want to thank you for bringing this resolution forward and the discussion. Because, you know, before this hearing, I'd heard of other experiences of the trauma of the boarding schools. And, you know, I relate as a mother, the hardest thing for me was sending my 6-year-old off to public school that was outside of my care. And that was one day. And the difference is that he came home at the end of the day. And looking at how our own government and our own churches could participate in this for such a long period of time is really hard to admit to that. And I think that's what makes it a difficult conversation, is that this is part of our history. But I want to thank you for your presentation, because at first it was challenging hearing what the Christian churches had done to Alaska Natives and really American Indians across the United States as part of a plan that is in relationship to religion. And I've recently been referred to as a Christian nationalist. And I said, well, I love my nation and I love Jesus, so I don't understand the problem. But what you've shown me in your presentation is that there's a very, very, very deep history that has created a lot of hardship that I was unaware of. And now I know why that term is being used in fear, is because of the concern that those same actions could happen again. And I think that's part of the entire purpose of this underlying bill that is in Congress, is to bring the understanding so that there can be healing. And I just want to appreciate, thank you for tying those two together, because one of the challenges of the topics in this committee is it's really heavy history to listen to, and it's almost too much, for the heart to bear. But these were our Alaskans who were bearing this burden, and so I just want to say that, as Christians today, and as someone who has been called a Christian nationalist, I do not agree or condone any of the actions of the past. However, it is part of our history, and I want to be a part of every part of healing that can come for Alaskans moving forward. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for making this resolution easy for us to be able to be a part of and sign on, because this is what is going to transform the next generation, is being able to talk about these hard things and be a part of the solution. So thank you.
Thank you for your remarks, Representative Vance. Are there any other comments that members would like to make before we proceed? I guess one thing I will just like to add is I appreciate the thanks. This feels weird, like I'm saying I appreciate the appreciation, but no. What I really just want to say is, I've never used this phrase before, so I hope I'm using it right. I feel like I'm standing on the shoulders of the work of others. I think that's the right use of that phrase. So what I really mean to say is I think all of the thanks goes to our presenters for having the strength and courage to speak about what they spoke about. And, your remarks has made me think, as heavy as it is for us to hear this information, I think it's important for us to remember that, those personal stories, those are stories that they held within themselves really their whole life. And I don't want to really speak for our presenters, but I think some of the stories they shared, it's the first time they've ever talked about it. And so, I just really want to thank everyone who made this presentation possible, the breadth of research that we heard. Mr. Dasik, you are incredibly impressive. There's a wealth of knowledge, and it is so just I don't want to say fascinating, because I think this is a really heavy topic, but there's just so much to glean. And I just want to thank you so much for your research. And of course, President Edenshaw, for being here and sharing your own story as well. So I've talked enough. Ms. Jaithluk-Sifsoff, did you have something to add?
For the record, my name is Callan Jaithluk-Sifsoff. And through the chair, I just wanted to thank each and every person here Monday and today for being here and for the eloquent words that have been stated. And these conversations are really important, so I appreciate everybody here.
Thank you. So with that, I would entertain a motion to move the bill.
I move HJR 17, Recorder 33-LS1019/U, with no amendments and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. Are there any objections? Seeing none, HJR 17 passes from committee. I will now take a brief at ease while we sign the committee report. Brief at ease. Briefly back on the record, just so you guys know, we have the wrong bill to be signed, so we're just getting that transferred. So I thought you could hear us. It was kind of funny. I was talking and you were like, but you couldn't hear me. But that didn't need to be on the record. Nonetheless, just want to let you guys know. We're going to go back to an at ease. So we are now back on the record. I want to thank everyone again for making this possible and for dedicating your time today. Of course, I would be remiss if I did not afford you the opportunity to make any closing comments. I know I've asked you like 3 times now, but if there's anything else you'd like to say before we depart, please go right ahead.
Mr. Chair, this is Emily. I just want to say thank you to the committee and to Callan and to our presenters for just for doing this. You know, this is why we do the work that we do, and you know, just being in the place where we've learned this history, and it just feels so good. I feel like we're taking this collective step forward in terms of healing, and I just really want to lift up our committee members, but also our auntie and uncle, Auntie Rosita and Uncle Joaquin Charles for testifying. I know that was really hard for them. I also want to just make sure to thank the statewide MMIWG work group. I know Kendra's not on the line, but I know that they provided written support of the resolution. And so I really would like to just say thank you. There are a lot of organizations that support this this resolution. And so I just want to extend my heartfelt thanks and gratitude. And to Representative Vance, thank you for sharing the words that you shared. I am leaving and ending my day on such a positive note. And like I said, I feel like we're taking this collective step forward, and I'm going to remember this moment for the rest of my life. So I just want to say, Koyana, thank you. And I'll turn it over to Ben.
Thank you, Emily. No, I just want to say thank you for letting us be able to tell these stories and the stories of those who, including my own grandfather, never be able to say it themselves. And so, thank you.
The next House Tribal Affairs Committee will be publicly noticed at a later date. The time is 4:38 p.m., and this hearing of the House Tribal Affairs Committee is now adjourned. Bucha.